Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, February 22nd, 2011, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-host, Lavendar. We are honored to present a very distinguished guest this evening, CNN correspondent-turned-screenwriter Bryce Zabel, has created five primetime television series, notably NBC's Emmy-winning UFO series Dark Skies, just released on DVD in January. This year, his just-published nonfiction book, AD After Disclosure, The People's Guide to Life After Contact, is being developed as a weekly television series by his production company, Stellar Productions and Electric Farm Entertainment. This book is also being released in the enhanced iBook format by Zentral Media. We strongly urge you to read this very important work. Bryce Zabel has quite an impressive list of accomplishments. In 2008, he received the Writers Guild of America Award for writing his third four-hour Hallmark miniseries, Pandemic. He has written multiple studio feature scripts, receiving credit on two produced films, Atlantis, The Lost Empire, and Mortal Kombat, Annihilation. He is currently under contract to write Magic Men about the Roswell investigation. He wrote sci-fi's first original film, Official Denial, and the first original film in the Unsolved Mysteries franchise. He also served as the elected chairman, CEO of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, and was responsible for the post-9/11 Emmy Awards, and has been an award-winning on-air PBS investigative reporter, an adjunct professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, and is a member of the Directors Guild of America, AFTRA, and the WGA. In addition to Dark Skies, Bryce has received the WGA Created By or Developed By credit on Kay O'Brien, Mantis, The Crow, Stairway to Heaven, ENG. His other series work includes Steven Spielberg's Taken, L.A. Law, Life Goes On, and Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. As I said, it's a very impressive list. Besides two WGA nominations and one win, his work has been nominated by the Environmental Media Association, Mystery Writers of America, and the L.A. Emmy Awards. You can visit his websites at brycezabel.com, that's BRYCEZABEL, and also afterdisclosure.com. Before I introduce Lavendar and Bryce, we're going to listen to an excerpt from AD After Disclosure, read by Paul Costanzo. We want to thank Sierra and Purple Sage for hosting the chat room and switchboard, and we'll be taking questions and comments later in the show, and please remember to be brief. The call-in number is 917-889-8292. We invite you to visit our website, starseedhotline.com, and our toll-free number is 888-881-0881. We also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. And now, here is an excerpt from AD After Disclosure.
This is an excerpt from AD After Disclosure, written by Richard Dolan and Bryce Zabel, read by Paul Costanzo. Chapter 3, Breakaway. How Secrets Created a World Within a World. Secrecy is the first essential in affairs of the state. Cardinal de Richelieu. If I could start again, a million miles away, I would keep myself. I would find a way. Nine-inch nails. Hurt. In 1960, the U.S. government contracted the prestigious Brookings Institute to prepare a report that would analyze the implications of the fledgling U.S. space program. The report, completed in December 1960, included an examination of the possibility that the space program might find evidence of intelligent alien life, such as artifacts on the moon or Mars. The implications were taken with great seriousness by the authors, who expressed fear of social disintegration if humanity came in contact with an extraterrestrial life form. Anthropological files contain many examples of societies sure of their place in the universe, stated the Brookings Institute writers, which have disintegrated when they had to associate with previously unfamiliar societies, espousing different ideas and different life ways. The authors suggested that if the U.S. space program found evidence of alien life or technology, it might be advisable to withhold this information from the public. The Brookings report reinforced a long-standing U.S. government policy. No less an authority than the former director of Central Intelligence, Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, admitted to a cover-up in a letter to the New York Times in 1960, shortly before publication of the report. "Behind the scenes, high-ranking Air Force officers are soberly concerned about UFOs," said Hillenkoetter. "But through official secrecy and ridicule, citizens are led to believe the unknown flying objects are nonsense. To hide the facts, the Air Force has silenced its personnel." Denial and ridicule in service to the state. Taking their cue from the national security community, reputable leaders within the media and academic world have discussed UFOs like a weary parent chastising a child for reading too many comic books. "These things are not real," we are told. "If you speak about them too much or too openly, people may think you have a screw loose somewhere." That is one reason why the cover-up has stood for so long. Only open minds cultivate facts in an honest way. If we had followed our own UFO glasnost policy from the beginning, this argument would be over. We would have discussed this problem in the editorial pages, on the nightly news, and over hot dogs at our kids' ball games, and we would have concluded that something was there. Except that the architects of the cover-up stumbled upon the twin concepts that enabled them to hide the truth from the people they were sworn to protect. Two pillars, each one lending strength to the other in service of the common goal. Denial and ridicule. Official denial works. When a general or leading scientist tells us there is no fire and the smoke is an illusion, our natural instinct is to believe, despite what the crazy neighbor thinks, sometimes despite the evidence from our own eyes. We want to believe our authority figures. We want to know that those in charge can be trusted. Ridicule gives denial its power. When official statements are made, language is of utmost importance. It is easier for listeners to smirk at a flying saucer than an unidentified flying object or unknown aerial phenomenon. It is easier to dismiss alien intelligence when it is characterized as little green men instead of extraterrestrial biological entities. Alien agendas can be dismissed when boiled down to science fiction scenarios in which the occupants land on the White House lawn and say, "Take me to your leader." Even the apparent widespread abduction of innocents has become the subject of ridicule on comedy shows, and the fact that these craft can operate quietly with great stealth capabilities is used to prove their lack of existence. Thus, even today, questions about the subject are often presented simplistically, often with a derisive sneer. "Do you believe in flying saucers piloted by little green men?" Imagine saying yes to that question. No one wants their reputation smeared. Such false and misleading framings of the question quickly convince the world's academic and journalistic institutions to run far and fast from the UFO subject. Indeed, in this dance of disinformation, it is sometimes difficult to tell, and often irrelevant, whether these institutions lead or follow. Craving public acceptance of their knowledge and authority, very few scientists, professors, or journalists can afford to show belief in the topic. As a result, the secret keeps itself, with only occasional government intervention.
Well, I would like to thank Mr. Paul Costanzo for doing this excerpt for us. And now I would like to introduce Lavendar, who will present Mr. Bryce Sable.
Thank you so much, Arielle, and I'm very, very excited about our guest. I want you to know that I have really thought long and hard about the possibility of the inevitable happening. And like I had said earlier, that when I even read the contents of this book, you know, I had to take a nap because I realized that a lot of the things that I had been working on the planet was really leading up to the day that we'd have this big event on the planet and disclosure would happen, whether or not our government comes forward and speaks or whether they just come and make their presence known. So I feel like that the people that listen to our Starseed Academy are the ones that will be responsible for knowing this information and how they handle their daily lives with their family, their friends, their community. It will be up to all of us to have the courage to stand in our alignment and say, yes, we've known this for a very long time, and we're here to bring the balance to it all. And so with that, I would like to have Bryce come on. Is he on the line?
I'm here.
Okay, Bryce, this is going to be a very great show.
Well,
and like
I hope
said,
so.
When the impossible becomes the inevitable, this is what we're going to be talking about. So I'd like to start out with, let's talk about when you were a kid and what inspired you and what was the set of circumstances that brought you along in the metaphysical world.
Well, I'll get to that in a second, but first, while you were introducing me, I came to two conclusions. First, I need fewer credits so that the show doesn't go over time. And second, I should hire Paul Costanzo to read our book because he did a brilliant job. And please pass on to Paul how effective I thought he was. That was really terrific work on his part. He really
made
it come alive.
Well, you know, when we had Richard on, he read the part about what the president was going to say. So
oh,
he
well.
Has done this before. And I had told Richard that I really hoped that Paul would have the opportunity to read your book. And Paul has been very, very instrumental in some very high-profile activities on the planet. He has worked in presidential campaigns. He's worked with celebrities. And he's been my friend for some time. And he's going to be on the line tonight. In fact, I know he's listening to what you just said.
Well, honestly, as I heard him, a few years ago I had a tape set back when there were cassettes, and there was a voice on the CyberVision tape that sounded just like Paul. I don't know if he worked back then, but he did a great job, and I can't wait for him to come on so I can give him my compliments.
Okay,
your question though is how I came to, I guess, get where I am today in terms of the whole disclosure topic. I started honestly, like most people, I didn't really think too much about it. I think as a kid I saw some television series like The Invaders and maybe a Santa Claus versus the Martians at the local theater, that kind of thing. One thing I do remember, though, is that my mother was a member of one book club, and one day one of the books that came was The Interrupted Journey. And she couldn't put it down, and then I snuck a read, and I really couldn't put it down either, although I remember thinking to myself at the time, this just is too crazy. It's too far out. It can't be real. So it's got to be made up. And I couldn't believe that it was, you know, being sold as a nonfiction book. I first I'm from Oregon. I came to Oregon in 1950. I was raised, well, I didn't come in 50. I wasn't alive then, but my parents did. And I was raised about 30 miles from McMinnville, which is where in 1950 those Trent photos were taken. The two classic photos that to this day have been studied and never discredited. So I kind of came of age in the shadow of UFOs, I guess you could say, in that regard. My turnaround, though, intellectually, really did not start from anything other than doing what a lot of people in Hollywood do, which is to say to yourself, this might make a pretty good movie. So in the 80s, I started to work on a spec screenplay, which at the time I called Progenitor, but eventually it became produced as Official Denial by the Sci-Fi Channel. It was their first original film. And I ended up reading a lot and studying a lot and getting into the topic so that I could write a good screenplay. But in the process, the more I learned, the more I said, wow, I had really no idea, but there is a lot here that you cannot discount. And over the years, I've continued to read to the point where it seems very clear to me that the one thing we could all agree on, and there is disagreement about what it all means, but the one thing we can all agree on at this point, and that I would say to anybody, is that at least some UFOs are actual physical craft of advanced technology from someplace that isn't here. That we all know. Now we're going to quibble about the details over time, but that has informed my thinking since, and as you pointed out, I've had a number of jobs that allowed me to express other ideas in this field. So that's kind of my story.
Okay, great. Well, so the greatest story never told is what I'm kind of thinking about what is happening with disclosure. What was the turning point for this particular book with Richard?
Well, as you mentioned, I've done things like Dark Skies. I worked on Steven Spielberg's Taken, got to talk UFOs with Steven Spielberg. That was pretty interesting. Those kind of things. I had sort of taken a step back, if you will, from ufology and thinking about such things. As you also mentioned, I ran the TV Academy in between. But then after all those things died away, I began to think that this was still a pretty good topic to stay current on, and I've always stayed current on it. And a couple of books caught my interest, UFOs in the National Security State, Volume 1 and Volume 2 by Richard Dolan. And I figured that they had to both be optioned because they were so incredible. But I thought I'd give it a try anyway. I used to be an investigative reporter. It's not that hard to find a phone number. I got Richard's phone number and called him up one day and said, I like your books. Here's who I am. I was just wondering if they've been optioned. And he said no. So the very first thing that happened about 15, 16 months ago was optioning both of Dolan's two books for film and television. And that was where we got to know each other. While we were discussing his books and possibly adapting them, we got to be friendly enough that at one point the conversation just ran to disclosure. Obviously, his books are all leading to disclosure, but I'd actually started typing up notes on a book about disclosure. And I sort of told him about it and said, what do you think of this? And he goes, these are my ideas exactly. That would be an awesome book. And I don't remember who said it first, but one of us said, well, why don't we write it together? Now, the interesting thing about that statement is that we both immediately said yes, but Richard had to put aside Volume 3 of his proposed trilogy to do it, and I had to put aside a project that was very near and dear to my heart to do it. And I believe he spent something like 7 years writing Volume 2, and we wrote our book in 7 months. We just both came to love it. We talked every day. We became very good friends. We wrote the whole thing on Google Docs together. He lives on the East Coast. I live on the West Coast. But we were able to stay in contact by email and phone and Google Docs, and the book was born that way, and it was one of the greatest writing experiences I've had. It was terrific fun. He's a brilliant, intelligent, and fun guy to hang out with, and I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, it's just a wonderful book, and I totally get behind everything that the two of you have decided to do with the book. And also, I want to say that when I have sessions with people during the day, there's not one person that I don't tell them about the book and tell them to go immediately to the website, order the book. If you can't get the book, please, you know, get it on ebook, because I stress this is the biggest event that they're going to witness in their lifetime. So get ready. And I say it every day. I don't know how many times.
Well, you are my new BFF, best friend forever. And I thank you for doing that. And in a way, I thought a lot about the social activism that's required to turn this situation around and hasten disclosure. And I think one of the things that you're doing is embracing one of those change items, whether it's our book or Richard's books or Leslie Kane's excellent book or any of the excellent books that are out there. I think what we have to stop doing is talking only to ourselves and only to those who believe pretty much as we do. And we have to start reaching out to our friends and our neighbors, our coworkers and our families who do not share our opinions, and we need to bring their game up. And one way to do it, as you've done, is to recommend a book. I have what I call my lending library. When I find a book that I really enjoy, I buy several copies of it so that I can always keep my copy at home, and I constantly lend it out to friends and ask them if they will open their mind long enough to read a book so that we can discuss it later. And I think we have to create this change for disclosure one mind at a time, which is, in effect, what your radio show is also doing. You're reaching people on a one-on-one basis, even though there are a lot of people listening. So congratulations for embracing that change element, and thank you so much for doing it with our book. We appreciate it.
Well, here's my next idea. I would love for a foundation to donate a book to every library in this country. That's one of my next projects.
That would be a great getting anyone to do anything in this economy or to pony up money for anything is very difficult. And I have another, besides the Every Library, one thought that I am considering is how to get a copy of this book into every congressman and senator's office in Washington, D.C., and every cabinet member's office, because I think that's very doable. It's really, you know, it's 500-plus copies of the book. Because I think what you have to do is start reaching out to those people as well and getting them ready so that they're ready to be courageous when their number is called.
Well, I already have that one kind of wired, too. I have one congressman reading it right now. I won't disclose his name right now, but it's in motion.
Well, that's terrific. I had someone call me just today saying that they were going to a book signing for Mike Huckabee, of all people, and they said they were giving him a copy of our book, telling him that it was to think of it as a briefing book, and that the first disclosure president will need to know these things, and it would be better to be Abraham Lincoln than Millard Fillmore. And you know, taking no position on the campaign or the candidates, I'd love it if all the candidates or at least their executive assistants took a read of such a book. And Leslie Kane's another good example. Those kind of books being read in the halls of power will at least change the dynamic and cause people to talk about this out loud. It's already started, you know, during the Clinton administration. He certainly asked Webster Hubble, his friend, to find out who killed JFK and what was going on with UFOs. Hubble was not able to get him that information, but Clinton's chief of staff, John Podesta, who was the head of the Obama transition team, has been very outspoken in favor of more disclosure, and he seems to be an important player in that area.
Yeah, I think so, too. Have you had any experiences where you witnessed up close and personal ET activities?
No, I have not. I am not one of the people who – there's a lot of ways people fall into this. One way, of course, is that they have exactly what you mentioned, where something happens to them, and from that point they become radicalized because they realize the thing I saw or experienced, other people are trying to tell me didn't happen. And since I know that it did happen – I'm experiencing cognitive dissonance, if you will, with the people who are in power. And that's one way to become quite a radical. The other way, though, is the way that I came to it, which is reading reports, reading books, looking for facts, and just trying to track down facts and trying to make sense of this whole thing. And the one thing that is quite clear is that there is a discontinuity between what the government, and not just our government, but many governments, have said and what they have done. Historically, they have said there's nothing to UFOs and so forth, but they all are also at the very same time investigating UFOs surreptitiously. So if there's nothing to it, why investigate it? And there's over the course of time, of course, there's been so many outstanding sightings with radar visual confirmation, with multiple witnesses, police witnesses, photos, videos. It's just overwhelming. I personally think there's a lot of hoaxes out there. I think there's a lot of people that have not been honest about it, but that doesn't mean just because there's a lot of noise doesn't mean there's not a signal. And it's quite clear to me, my radicalization just came by realizing as I continued this reading that of course there's something that's been going on, and the only question is what the details of it are. And so, for example, if you read Richard Dolan's first two books in his UFOs and the National Security State, you can't read those books and not say something's been going on for quite a while. You can't read Leslie Kane's book and not say, my goodness, these cases seem to be very solid, and they seem to have been observed by very solid witnesses. So that's how I came to it, not through being an experiencer. And I'm not even sure I'd want to be an experiencer. I don't really know how I feel about that, because it's a very mixed bag between the very good that gets reported and some of the very bad that gets reported. So it's kind of open season for me on that topic.
Well, you know, maybe you're being kept where you are so you can be objective and be the writer that you need to be the way you are just now. I mean, it might change everything about you to the point where you couldn't be as objective as you are now. So
well,
I think you're at the right place at the right time.
That's a good point. I think we all have a role to play in this coming disclosure. And one of the things that will be necessary in disclosure is people coming forward over time who are not perceived in any way as flaky, but very grounded people. So I would go to the John Podesta model for that. When disclosure first is uttered, it won't be full disclosure. It'll be some kind of partial disclosure. But you'll have guys like John Podesta saying, yes, this is true. And so for a lot of the people who, remember, your audience, myself, and yourself, we all are obviously attuned to the fact that there is some more to reality than we perceive in our daily lives. But most people are not.
Right.
Most people's lives are defined by going to work, getting the car tuned up, going to their kids' soccer games, and the sort of things that make up our daily lives. And they've not given this any thought at all, partly because of the book excerpt that was read by Paul Costanzo pointed out, denial and ridicule. Those two twin pillars of the cover-up that were instituted in the late 40s have worked beyond the wildest dreams of the architects of that secrecy, to the point that I don't believe the secret keepers have to do all that much work to keep the secret anymore. We keep it for ourselves, because the average person doesn't have an open mind on the topic, and the person who does have an open mind is fearful that if they speak out openly, they will be ridiculed or condemned or ostracized by the people they care about.
Right. You know, back in 1996, when your series Dark Skies came out, I was so excited, because I said, who is this guy that's writing this? I don't know how he knows this. So can you tell us a little bit about how that miniseries came about, and do you think it's more relevant now than when it first came out?
I think it is more relevant. The story of how it came about, though, is complex, and I won't get into all the details. We can talk more if we need to, but the short version of it is that I'd been coming off that movie that had been made for the Sci-Fi Channel called Official Denial, and I'd also been producing a television series, and my assistant at the time, her husband, she was also a writer, and she said, and he knows a story that you really need to hear. Since she knew that I had an interest in UFOs. And so I met this man for lunch, Brent Friedman, and he told me a story about a Washington insider that curled my toes and opened my mind at the same time. He and I began to kick ideas back and forth, and we became compelled to try to write a television series that was what we called the Grand Unification Theory of Conspiracy. We wanted to take the two biggest conspiracies of all time, the Kennedy assassination and UFOs, and put them in an atom collider and see what would happen if they smashed together. And Dark Skies was the result. Dark Skies takes place in the 1960s. The pilot episode is literally about disclosure. President Kennedy is planning to disclose the reality of UFOs in his second term when he is murdered. And then the series goes on from there and becomes kind of a tone poem to the discussion of disclosure. The young, naive character at the beginning of the series, a character named John Lowengard, believes that the people have a right to know, and the wise veteran who's heading Majestic 12 and has kind of a contempt for the public thinks the public can't handle the truth. He's sort of in the Jack Nicholson role from A Few Good Men. And they sort of have that fight throughout the series, if you will, to disclose or not to disclose. And I think it's relevant now. I would hasten to add that you can't watch that DVD set, which I really enjoyed getting to watch myself after all this time. You can't watch it and say these guys think everything in it is true. It, it's it's not. It is a it's a work of fiction, of course. But we did try very, very hard to respect some of the basics of ufology and to incorporate as much of it as we could. So in addition to the series having real characters that range from the Beatles to Howard Hughes to Carl Sagan to Ronald Reagan to Timothy Leary and Jim Morrison and characters like that all the way through, we also tried very hard to pull in the ufology elements, such as Betty and Barney Hill, who are in the pilot. We do the Socorro, New Mexico landing case in an episode. And we touch on lots of those touchstones for the whole business of researching UFOs. So it's kind of a rewarding journey for an audience. And the reason I think it's more relevant now is I think we're closer to disclosure than we've ever been before. But I also think the series can be experienced in a way that it couldn't when it was first out. When it was first out, there were no DVRs. And it was on Saturday night. And most people don't try to stay home on Saturday night. They try to go out and have fun. So people were missing lots of episodes, and they didn't know if they were able to pick it right back up again. And the network was preempting it over baseball games and all that kind of craziness. Well, when you have a DVD set today, you can sit down and you can watch one episode and then a second and then a third, and you can watch it as fast as you want, and you never miss an episode. And I found that when I was rewatching it to do the audio commentaries for it, I was surprised at how close we were to getting things right. The alien invasion aspect of it, I realize, is not necessarily the thing that you know, your show or anyone would necessarily respond to, but it was the dramatic element. It was a metaphor more than anything, a way to tell the story of disclosure. But I'm really heartened by how many big idea concepts that are very much alive today are still in that series. Very proud of it, and thank you for mentioning it.
Well, it's a blockbuster, too, I noticed. So is it doing well? Is it selling well?
It did great. It came out last month, and in the first week it came out, it was number 4 on Amazon among all DVD box sets. So I consider that to be pretty darn good, especially for a series that's been off the air and was not getting a lot of promotion. And the only DVD sets that were better than it were things like Mad Men and other shows that are on the air right now and have a lot of fans. So
how many episodes are in the series?
It's a full season. It's a 20-hour ride that takes you from 1961, when John Lowengard comes to Washington, D.C. and goes to work for a congressman. His girlfriend goes to work for JFK in the White House. It takes you from 1961 through the Summer of Love in 1967, over a 20-hour episodic period. And it touches all characters and events. We have episodes about Vietnam, about the civil rights movement, about Beatlemania. We try to tie every major event in because I guess here's how we looked at it. I happen to believe Roswell is a true and well-researched event, truly did happen. Nobody's making that up. It's the real deal. If Roswell is the real deal and it happened in 1947, then you can be sure that lots of things that you think are the way things really are not really that way. A lot of things had to have been done differently because of that. So our catchphrase, if you will, which is a nice way people use to talk about their television series, he says our catchphrase was history is a lie.
Yeah.
Because the history that you're reading in the textbooks of the 50s and the 60s does not mention UFOs. And yet it should, because they're real and they were happening on the public consciousness, and certainly in the halls of power they were obsessed by them during this period, something that is very clear from Richard Dolan's first two books. So very relevant and very, very important.
Well, I plan on going and getting it, and for 20 hours, well, that'll be probably a weekend, and I'll get lots of popcorn, and I'll just do something called guided vegetation.
Well, I hope you enjoy yourself. I look at it was very odd for me to have the timing be what it is right now, though, to have Dark Skies being released at the same time as AD After Disclosure was being released.
It's
because
so
let's face it, Dark Skies is a fiction series purporting to be true, and AD After Disclosure if you know UFOs are real, you can look at that book as a nonfiction book. But a lot of people who don't give UFOs that credibility see the book as a piece of fiction, which is odd to me. But I tell them, I tell the non-believers, if you will, that it is a piece of speculative nonfiction, and that belief is not a requirement of reading it. They can read it and take a look at it simply as a chance to, I don't know, I guess just to a tremendous what if.
Yeah.
What if UFOs were real? What if this announcement was made to the world? What would happen? Now, you and I and your viewer, your listeners, all know that UFOs are real and that this disclosure is coming sooner than later. And when it happens, it's going to change everything. So we know that it's nonfiction, but some people may see it as otherwise.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Majestic 12 and how. Can you give us a brief description of how you came across these documents, and what is your take on them?
Well, it's a complicated issue, and I won't deny that it divides ufology almost like a political party. You almost have the Republicans and the Democrats of ufology divided over whether the Majestic documents are real. So before I get into the detail of that, I would just say, if the Majestic documents aren't real, then it's almost irrelevant, because since Roswell was real, some organization has been managing this secret for a very long time, going back to the 40s. I personally think they're real. I base that on a number of reasons, but one of which is that I'm quite close with Stanton Friedman. In fact, I've optioned his book, Top Secret Magic, as well as Don Schmidt's book, Witness to Roswell, and I'm currently writing a movie called Magic Men about their Roswell investigations. But I'm swayed by not only Stanton Friedman's passion on this topic, but also by the hard work that he has done that very few people do, which is to go to government archives and to chase down the details. And every time someone raises an objection, he goes and figures out why it's not an objection. He's the most dogged researcher I've ever met in my life, and he is doing the work that Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein should have done. So I tend to come down on the idea that they're real. I've used Majestic 12 creatively in a couple of dramatic projects. Official Denial on Sci-Fi Channel was about Majestic 12 and their attempt to actually shoot down a craft by using an abductee as bait in a something called Operation Forced Encounter. I also used Majestic 12 in Dark Skies. So Dark Skies, literally, Majestic 12 is a character in the series. The young man, John Lonegard, ends up being so obsessed with tracking down the Frank Bach character who runs Majestic 12 that when he finally exposes him, he's basically recruited himself into the organization, whether he wanted to or not. I think they're fascinating documents. I do agree that they came to the forefront in a way that is less than ideal. In other words, they were a film that was taken of paper rather than the actual paper itself. But frankly, we live in a world that's not perfect. It would be perfect to have that and we could go analyze it, but that's not how they came to be leaked. The people who leaked them, that's the only way they could leak them. So that's how they were the whistleblowers, and we just have to take it as it is. I do know that it's tremendously dramatic. One of the scenes in Magic Men, for example, is the person who has done the most to authenticate them, Stanton Friedman, was literally in a hospital where his son was dying, sadly, of AIDS when he saw them for the first time. And I find that to be incredibly dramatic. It's in the movie Magic Men. And I guess at the end of the day, I just am swayed by the arguments in their favor, even though I admit that it is a controversy.
I'd like to ask you about the actors that were in Dark Skies.
Sure.
After they played these roles, did they become interested in this subject, and have you stayed in contact with any of them?
Yes. Frank Bach was played by J.T. Walsh, who sadly died after the series. He died the summer after the series stopped production. So the last thing he ever did in his career was Dark Skies. And I'm I think he'd be proud of his work. He managed to have it. You know, he was a feature film actor primarily, so he was used to coming in and doing a two-hour movie and then moving on to the next thing and a new character. Here he was able to explore the Frank Bach character for 20 hours. He did a brilliant, brilliant job. I mean, I don't know if everyone who you're who's listening will immediately spark to who this man is, but when you watch the show, you will go, oh, it's him. And it is the most sizzlingly interesting, compelling performance you're going to see if you watch anything this year. The two leads I'm very close to right now, Eric Close played John Lohengard. He's currently starring in a new television series. I think it's called Chaos, but he was in Without a Trace for many years after Dark Skies. A fantastic actor. And Megan Ward played his girlfriend, Kimberly Sayers. They were on the run together, if you will, trying to stay one step ahead of Majestic 12. I think she's on General Hospital right now. She looks better than ever. We all got to have kind of a reunion when we met to do the Dark Skies audio commentaries. And it was like we hadn't been apart a day. Everybody was laughing. And it was. And that's one thing people say when they listen to these DVD commentaries. They say, you guys sound like you were having the best time in the world, and we really were. It was great to see them again. And the other thing that I'm proud of about the actors on Dark Skies is you have only limited budget in a television series, so you don't have so much money that you can just get all the actors you want as regulars. So what we ended up doing is hiring certain actors to be in certain episodes as day players, and then we would bring them back in future episodes over and over again so they look like they're members of the series. So, for example, James Kelly plays Bobby Kennedy in the series, and it looks like he's a regular, and he's all through it. We have a number of characters who are like that, and as you watch Dark Skies, it really does feel like you're watching a movie. The director was Toby Hooper, and he's, you know, a pretty famous feature director, and also the director of photography was the man that did Jaws, and they tried very hard to give the pilot episode a look that was like The Godfather, if you will. So it's kind of Godfather of UFOs.
So do you find a lot of people in Hollywood really believing in disclosure? Do you find a lot of other directors and writers that are stimulated like you are?
Not really. I think my feeling about Hollywood and UFOs is a little more nuanced than most people. I don't think Hollywood has been as overtly manipulated by intelligence agencies and so forth as some people would like to believe. And I don't think they need to be manipulated, because the truth is all these alien movies and invasion movies and science fiction with alien movies, they're not being made because anyone has told Hollywood they should make them. They're being made because those writers, directors, actors, and studios think alien movies are big box office, which they are. So, I mean, Avatar is an extraterrestrial film, but nobody thought it had anything to do with disclosure. I do think there are certain key people in Hollywood that are key to the concepts of disclosure. Obviously, Steven Spielberg is. He's very well aware that UFOs are real. A friend of mine, Don Most, is producing with me on Magic Men, and Don, people know, oddly, as Ralph Malph from Happy Days, but he's quite knowledgeable in the UFO field. I come across people often who know a lot about UFOs, but mostly, though, I find that Hollywood is pretty much like normal life. In other words, in normal life, you probably got 2, 3, 4 friends who either believe or are willing to tolerate your belief in a jovial way about the whole thing. And then you've got some people, including probably members of your family, who think you're a little bit crazy. And
yeah,
I think Hollywood's about the same proportions of all of the above.
Yeah. Can you comment on, you talked about choke points within the system to keep
sure.
this a secret. What are these choke points?
Well, a choke point is simply a way that you're able to, when there's an outbreak of truth, if you will, you can squash it and keep it from flaming up. It used to be easier to have choke points in a world that wasn't an internet world, because obviously if there was a UFO sighting in a small town and it made it in a small town's paper, the choke points for that were to make sure that it didn't get in the larger city newspapers and it didn't get to in the national press. And probably there were some people who had relationships with intelligence and so forth that could be useful in choking that off. Another choke point, though, is just our resistance to accepting this idea as a reality. So academia has become a choke point. If you want to go study UFOs, you're putting your entire academic career in danger if you try to do it at most universities. A few people have bravely done it. They suffered the consequences. Most people stay away as best they can. I think a strategy has shifted over the years. Choke point used to refer to, I think, squeezing off a flow of information so that it didn't go wide. But since we live in an internet world where, you know, someone in the smallest possible town can still reach out to someone anywhere else on the globe, choke point has become a slightly altered concept. Instead, what I think the secret keepers do now is rely on believers to distribute their own false information. And I think it's not impossible to believe, it's certainly not hard to believe, that disinformation is easily offered in today's environment. So say that there is a credible real sighting that goes on, it's not hard at all to diffuse that sighting with crazy talk, with possibly fake people posting new fake photos. This whole thing with the Jerusalem sighting is a good example. It may be true, it may be false. It would be hard to make a decision right now because there's been so much written that most people simply would throw up their hands and go, I don't know what to make of it. You know, I mean, some of them look fake, some of them aren't fake. It's just really hard to get your arms around it. So I think choke points has changed from choking off information to more like splatter points, I would say. Choke points to splatter points.
What about that Saudi Arabia meeting that happened over there where we had some ufologists and some...
Yes.
Some really high-profile people talking about technologies that possibly the ETs were going to come with and how could they make money with them. Have you heard anything about that?
Absolutely. My friend Stanton Friedman was one of the speakers there. It was called the Global Competitiveness Forum, and it was held in late January of this year in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And I don't want to overpaint it. What it is, it was a three-day conference of very high-end, powerful, wealthy decision makers who come together to talk business and the economy and so forth over a 3-day period. 1 hour and a half session in that 3-day period was devoted to UFOs. Now, it's a pretty high level gathering. Bill Clinton was, I believe, their opening speaker, and Stanton was on a panel with people that included Nick Pope and some other people. And they all spoke to the reality of UFOs and how acknowledging that reality and how that reality, whether it's acknowledged or not, still has lessons that can be learned. But let's be honest, most of the people that came to that Global Competitiveness Forum, in my opinion, know next to nothing about UFOs. And an hour and a half is hardly enough time to do justice to the concept. What really needs to happen would be a UFO forum that was basically a live briefing for power brokers and decision makers. And if you spent 3 days in other words, that's a good example of where another UFO conference, for those of us who believe in UFOs, who have heard all these speakers speak three times, may not change the world. But a UFO conference aimed at the decision makers and the power brokers of the world that would bring their game up and their knowledge level up on this topic, that would be powerful and awesome. So I look at what Stanton attended in Riyadh as a great first step. It is certainly a moment of legitimacy that is needed and necessary, and it is not a final ending to anything. It is only a tentative and almost timid beginning, but it is a beginning, and
I'm
very thankful.
Code that was thrown, and, you know, 3 days later, Egypt happened, so it's
right.
Like, okay, it was kind of like a roll that was happening.
Yeah, I, listen, we live in a world where an idea can catch fire. And I think if I were to summarize anything from what Richard Dolan and I concluded in our 7 months of back and forth and discussion that led to the creation of AED After Disclosure, we certainly believe that. We believe that the difference about disclosure now, people have been predicting disclosure since Donald Kehoe was writing books in the 50s. The difference is, look around you. We are in a wired world. We're in a world where an idea can catch fire and just run like that. So we think at some point, some collection of events are going to come together. It will probably involve some kind of sighting that has radar visual. It'll involve multiple witnesses. It will be recognized on video and photos from multiple angles and locations. And it'll be hard to deny that will lead to something. You might throw in a WikiLeaks document around that time, maybe a deathbed confession. More and more people talking about it. And then suddenly what will happen is when there is sufficient discussion, it will give the topic legitimacy. And those of us who have been sort of biting our tongues and biding our time will start speaking out all over the world. And then the people who have suspected that it might be true but have tried to turn the other way will start talking too. And it'll be like a wildfire. And when the wildfire ignites, and it will ignite, when it happens, it will be like the Berlin Wall. It'll be like Egypt falling, Mubarak's exit. Those kind of things happen fast. It was inconceivable that the Berlin Wall could come down, but when it came down, it was over in such a stunningly fast period of time, it took your breath away. The same thing will happen with, and the same thing happened if you think about it in Egypt, 2 weeks from the beginning to the end. I mean, that's pretty fast.
That's right.
Spreading across the rest of the Middle East. An idea is a powerful, powerful thing, but an idea that is rooted in truth is almost unstoppable.
An idea whose time has come.
Yes.
I wanted to go to a statement you made in your book. You said, when the financial industry stands down, the military will stand up. Can you give us insight to that chapter in your book?
Sure. One of the things we do that I don't think anyone has ever done in a book is we literally stick our necks out and start making predictions. We start predicting when disclosure might be announced. We give word. We explain what the president might even say. We talk about how disclosure will change from the first day to the first week to the first month to the first year. We literally decided not to be timid but to be bold. Because in our opinion, our book is not the end of the process, it's the beginning of the process. And it's meant to stimulate a discussion worldwide. So the two things that you're referring to, the economy standing down, what we specifically meant by that was we looked for cues in the past. In the past, after 9/11, the stock market was closed down. So after disclosure, the stock market will be closed down for a short period of time. In the past, FDR called a bank holiday so that the banks could stabilize themselves. We think such a thing might happen again. So that's what we kind of mean by initially the economy stands down so that it can try to calm whatever jitters are going to happen. But I think it's pretty clear that the economy will be jittery for the first year of disclosure at least. So it will be a time of some economic turbulence, and there's just no getting around that. Doesn't mean it's bad. It doesn't mean you're going to lose your shirt, but it does mean that to the extent that there ever is a calm time in the world, that this will not be one of them. But what we also mean in the instant, as the economy is sort of being put on hold by the powers that be to let them stabilize themselves, the military will have to stand up. If you think about it, from the moment that any public figure, and in our view, it'll be multiple public figures all at the same time in some kind of coordinated approach when it finally happens. When those public figures step forward and say, well, okay, yes, it is true, there is some reality to UFO and ET reality, and we're sorry. When they make that statement, you can believe that the militaries of the entire world will go on, you know, red alert. The U.S. military will go to DEFCON 1 instantly. It'll be a DEFCON 1 prior to disclosure, and it will stay there for a while as people look around and see if there's any response to disclosure. I mean, one thing we haven't really talked about is just because we disclose to ourselves the reality that there are other intelligent beings who are observing, participating, interacting with us, doesn't mean that those intelligent beings will have no response to our own disclosure. After all, if you think about it, there is one thing, we call them the others because we don't want to say extraterrestrial because there may be different versions. There may be intelligent beings from other places, but so we call them the others. But the one thing that we can say with certainty is that the others and the secret keepers have had one thing in common for the at least the last 65 years, and that is they agree that we should keep it secret. Because both sides have had the ample opportunity to make it not a secret, and yet they haven't done it. So when we decide, for reasons that could change or it could be different, but when we decide to disclose, there may be a response from the other intelligent beings out there, and it's unclear what it will be, but we do know the human response would be to put up our dukes and be ready to fight if we have to. So that will happen.
You talk about martial law, and it'll be probably declared in various places around the world. What are some of those places that you think will react in this way?
Well, let me be clear. I'm not trying to be a doomsday person here because I'm essentially an optimist, and Richard Dolan is also an optimist. But we are trying to be pragmatic. One of the things, if there's a blizzard coming in, people go clean out the store shelves. So what we think is there's going to be, as there is in any natural disaster, there's always human nature to deal with, and you have to acknowledge that some of that will happen. So after a disclosure statement, which will be shocking, it's inevitable that all kinds of people are going to go run down to their Costco or their local supermarket and buy anything they can get their hands on. That's human nature. Well, what does that do? Well, as the news covers shelves that are bare, people get anxious and scared. And some of them will start looting. That's just inevitable because they're scared. And we've seen it happen before. So in some places, martial law will have to be declared as you would declare martial law after an earthquake if there's looting going on. This is a short-term issue, but it will be amplified and made and rendered more difficult in the post-disclosure world for one real reason. Martial law is the government stepping in to tell you what to do, and after disclosure, the governments of the world will be revealed, particularly the United States government, as being in collusion to keep the secret. So in other words, the guys that have pulled the wool over your eyes for the last six decades are now going to tell you to stay off the streets at night, and there's going to be some pushback from that. And we live in a country that's heavily armed, so there's going to be some ragged edges to a disclosure statement. Rich and I, in many ways, try to liken the post-disclosure environment. The hard-edged analogy would be the Iraq invasion. You would have thought that we would have had a better plan going into Iraq, and we would have known people were looting, and we should have realized we needed to protect museums, etc., and restore order, but we didn't. And we didn't see IEDs coming, and we didn't see a lot of things coming that we should have. Well, we think disclosure will have some analogy to that, that there are certain things that probably should have been done pre-disclosure, but they won't be. It'll take some people by surprise, and what will have to happen in the aftermath is we're going to have to figure out on the fly what we can do to set things right. So, could be a little bumpy in the immediate aftermath. First year is definitely going to be unusual. It will be the most historic time in our history so far. But if you presuming that the others have reasonable good intent, and if they don't, that we are still able to make our case in an effective way, you go out 10 years from disclosure and things should be pretty normal, other than the fact that we will now be on a path toward some kind of enlightenment as a species.
Right. How do you think the media at large will handle disclosure? What do you think their first take?
Well, the one thing that Rich and I have said is that there will be winners and there will be losers in disclosure. And what's funny is that many of the worst losers are still going to be winners because there's no alternative to them. And the media is the perfect example. If you take a look at the media as it exists today, you'd have to say these people have completely and totally missed the boat. For 70 years, UFOs have been a practical reality around us, and they have avoided covering them with any legitimacy at all. And as I pointed out earlier, instead of Woodward and Bernstein trying to break cosmic Watergate, they wouldn't be caught dead, and their investigative journalistic brethren wouldn't be caught dead actually looking into UFOs. All right. So along comes disclosure, and the entire media industry has missed the boat on that thing. So the public is rightfully going to say, what's wrong with you people? Why didn't you help out? Where were you? You were missing in action. So there'll be a little righteous indignation against the media. But here's the irony. After disclosure, what is going to happen? We're all going to turn on our television sets, and we're going to buy every magazine off every stand, and we're going to buy every newspaper because we're going to know we're living through history. Well, we need the media to cover those news stories and to write those newspapers and magazines and websites and things like that. We'll do some of our own blogging, of course, but the establishment media will be perceived as necessary. So I look for the established media to do a double, triple backflip with a twist as they try to reorient themselves from being the guys that blew it to the guys that are now going to set themselves up as covering it for us.
Oh, well, I hear what you're saying. How about religions? Do you think that some will want to go to war over disclosure?
I don't. I will preface what I'm about to say about religion with one thing. It depends on what is disclosed. I mean, there's almost nothing I've said that couldn't stand that preface. The people who have the details are not talking to me right now. They haven't told me what things I don't know. So depending on what ultimately turns out to be disclosure will affect certain things. But on the subject of religion, I found our research into religion to be very fascinating because quite often, in my experience as a reporter, you start to look into a story and then you have certain expectations for what the answer is and what the story is going to be. And if you have an open mind about it, you start to look into it and you go, well, that's not actually the way it is. And you have to change your opinion. Religion's one of those. First of all, there are certain religions like the Catholic Church which are doing a lot right now to be prepared for disclosure and making many, many active comments about the fact that the universe may very well be populated with other non-human life and that they accept and welcome that. So they're either they know something or they just suspect something, but they're definitely reorienting themselves. But here's the reversal of expectation angle to it. It has historically been thought in all the books about contact that I've ever seen, and most of those are about contact through radio telescopes as opposed to close contact, but that somehow religion will freak out and they won't be able to handle it. And that's not what we found. There have been three major studies done of religious people, and the expectation going in all studies was that religious people would freak out. As it turns out, the fact of the matter is the people who think religious people will freak out about disclosure of extraterrestrial life are, in fact, atheists and agnostics. The actual religious people don't say they'll freak out by large numbers, getting up into the top 80s and 90%. They're pretty cool with it because many people said, and this applies to Muslim, Hindu, Christian, Catholic, all the religions of the world across the board have many of the same numbers, which is it just means that God's universe is bigger than we perceived at one time, but that God is the master of everything. And so, of course, he would put, other life forms out there, and if he did, that's okay by us. So it was truly a fascinating thing to realize that. There's one side angle to that, though, which is that the evangelical community may be somewhat disturbed, because the evangelical community, as opposed to the traditional establishment religion community, believes that. Let me put it this way: if you talk to an evangelical about UFOs, you'll find that they may know more about UFOs than you do. They just don't think they're extraterrestrial or ultra-dimensional or anything. They think they're angels and demons. So,
yeah. Yeah.
So those people aren't going to be happy with disclosure. Although I don't think they'll be as surprised. I think a lot of them will shrug and say, well, we knew this was coming. Don't be fooled. So, we think disclosure in religion will probably have some look like this. Certain religions, like the Catholic Church, will have already set in motion their bona fides to maintain their leadership, and they will survive. Most religions will, if they're fast acting, will figure out how to pivot and reposition themselves to be okay in a disclosure environment. A few won't, and they will probably wither up and go away. And at the very least, at least one new religion, and probably several, are going to come out of this.
Right.
And could I tell you what those religions will be? Not yet, but in the same way that I would say you can predict there'll be new political parties that will form out of disclosure, there will also be new religions.
Wow. Give us some arguments opposing disclosure. What are some of their arguments that want to oppose it?
Well, we did spend some time on that, and we devote a chapter where we literally say, well, if there is a secret keeper group, a Majestic 12 or a breakaway group, as we called it, and they were debating this, they might very well appoint a member on each side to debate it. And I want to make clear, I'm a citizen advocate, if you will, for disclosure. I believe that we should have disclosure. I just feel like it's time and that we'll have to handle the truth, no matter what it is, and that it might be bumpy and messy, but we have to do it. We have to go through it because that's part of our growth to adulthood. Having said that, I'm not arguing that there aren't reasons that the secret has been kept over the years. So if I was arguing on the other side about why we shouldn't disclose, I think some key arguments would be, well, look, we're still not on top of this thing yet. You could say the public's right to know is not an absolute, especially during wartime. So it may very well be that some of these secret keepers believe that this is a Cold War, not unlike the U.S.-Soviet standoff. And it very well may be that they feel that they have some information that some of these others, maybe not all of them by any means, clearly not all of them, some of them may have some hostility or may appear to be hostile, and therefore you wouldn't want to panic the public. And panic has always been the reason against disclosure, that the public will somehow panic. It goes back to 1938 when War of the Worlds was broadcast by Orson Welles. And I also think you could have one argument about disclosure where there is no such thing as simple disclosure. It's like being a little bit pregnant. So if disclosure was as simple as saying, well, there's one other kind of others, and here's what we know about them, and it was nice and simple, maybe. But probably, and again, I don't have inside knowledge, but probably the reality that would be disclosed is vastly more complex than that, very challenging. And it may very well be that the secret keepers are elitists, and they simply feel that it's better not to try to reveal that kind of truth to an entire 7 billion person planet, because it will just get it will be misunderstood. And I think that leads to the largest rationale opposing disclosure, which would be if we tell people the truth, the results are unpredictable. They don't know how it'll go.
Yeah.
And people always fear change. So the status quo, bad as it might be, it to some people may be something that they would favor.
I noticed that you refer to a group called the Breakaway Group.
Sure.
Who are they?
Well, we can go back to the late 40s, where I do think there was a Majestic 12. It may very well be that there is no longer a Majestic 12, or that that phrase has been retired. So Rich and I felt, in terms of our book, that we should try to come up with a more neutral term so that we weren't involved in arguing the case for Majestic 12 one way or the other. So Rich's concept that he advanced in his second book was that, and first book, was that of a breakaway civilization, the idea that the people who have maintained and managed the secret these many years have created what in essence is a separate civilization from ours. Yes, they live within our civilization, but they also have their own civilization that we're not privy to. So that would be the breakaway group. We felt that it was an easier way for us to discuss them, because we also think that what's happened in the 60 years is it's what Eisenhower warned about, the military-industrial complex. What's happened over the years, people work in government, then the administration changes, they go into private enterprise, then their guy gets elected, they go back into government. There's a lot of back and forth between government, public, and private. So we tend to think the breakaway group is populated by elite individuals that draw from both public and private enterprise, and it's no longer just a military classified organization, but it's something different. And by the way, what we never said was, what are the arguments supporting disclosure? I just wanted to quickly hit those. I think the arguments supporting disclosure are more persuasive. The first would be, the world just has too many problems to let this go on any longer, and we just got to get this over with so that we can put everything on the table. All cards should be on the table, all knowledge, because we need everything that we can get on the table to survive. Another argument would be, and it's just a basic moral argument that I would make, there are moments when secrecy are necessary. You're in World War II, you've got to have some secrecy. There are moments where it's appropriate. But overall, on the big issues, over time, the public does have a right to know. It's just an absolute. Over time, on big issues, we should know. Well, this is now 60-plus years. They've had 60 years to figure out what to do, and it's time to go to the next phase. And that's what leads me to the third and final reason, which is the initial reason for the cover-up, which was to give us time to assess probably what the danger was or what was going on, and prepare the public. That initial phase has long passed. It's time to get on with things. So I think the breakaway group, it's probably the scariest thing they've ever debated. They probably debated disclosure more than a few times. But this time, they're going to have to debate it. They're going to have to take a deep breath, slap some cold water on their face, and go out and do it.
This breakaway group, do you think they're responsible for those underground bases and in the tunnels and all the strangeness that's been happening all over the planet? I know there was an author that wrote In Plain Sight. Do you think that breakaway group is part of this?
Well, I guess I do. Lots of people have had opportunities to build underground bases and so forth, and they started out as being military. Most of them are probably military. There are probably other underground bases here and there that are controlled by other interests. But it does seem to me that there may be something going on beyond just the military bases. There may be, these black budgets that have supported the breakaway group all these many years have been massive. And if they have, in fact, come up with a kind of technology that allows for an easier creation of underground tunnels and bases, they've probably been using it. It's not like we can't do it right now, but it wasn't easy to build the tunnel between England and Paris. We did it, but it was a long, hard, involved process, and it's hard to do those in secret. So I would tend to think that if there is a wide global tunneling system or underground system, that it is part of a kind of technology that we simply are not quite aware of at this point.
Well, do you think maybe the extraterrestrial technology might be helping with that?
Might. It kind of goes back to, again, who are they and what do they want? It is possible there are some others who may, in fact, be in greater comfort underground or in our oceans, or maybe that's where they come from. It's hard to say. Somebody that has advanced technology sufficient to transit from way out there to way over here probably has some technology to create a tunnel that is slightly more advanced than just blowing stuff up. So, yeah, I think it's entirely possible. Or it's a combination. It may very well be that some of the materials we've gained access to over the years have been able to be sort of reverse engineered and thought about and applied in different ways, and that is what's happening right now. It's a good point. This is one of those things where no one has come forward with detailed, specific accounts that would cause me to say yes or no. I really don't know.
Have you ever talked to anybody that had inside information about the black budget and how these projects get funded in secret?
I've talked to numerous people who claim to be insiders, and I've heard some whistleblowing kind of tales specific to the black budget. Not so much. The way that most people tend to talk about that is it's a siphoning of funds, I think if you're really trying to talk about where the black budget comes from, again, you look to where it historically has come from. Reagan was, you know, did the Iran-Contra way to get money shifted around. The joke is, now you know why a toilet costs $500 in the military, because they're siphoning money. I really don't know. Clearly, a lot of money has been spent on military, and a few years ago, it seems to me they lost I think they had 100 and plus billion dollars unaccounted for in Rumsfeld's administration when he came in and started looking around. So there's a lot of money chasing around out there, and I will say this, one of the predictions that Rich and I are willing to make is that in a post-disclosure environment, academia is going to come alive too, just like the media, and they're going to start studying and writing papers and so forth. And one of the areas that will be fantastically exhilarated by disclosure will be the economics departments. And they're going to have a field day trying to analyze the question you just asked me. Where did the money come from to fund the black budgets? How was it laundered? How did it all happen for six decades so that we didn't know where it was coming from and we didn't know what it was buying?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I'd like to get your book in all the libraries. Let's get this started.
Yeah, I do think you make a good point. It is time to get this party started. And the way we have to do it is we have to begin to talk about it amongst ourselves. That's okay. No problem there, because we're the ones that know the most about it. But as we learn more, we have to do exactly what you're talking about. We have to reach out to the public libraries, to our public officials, to our friends, neighbors, and coworkers, and we have to start telling them in ways large and small, you know, it wouldn't hurt you to start getting ready for this because it's coming.
All right. Do you have a whistleblower story that's kind of interesting that our listeners would like to hear about, something that's kind of just out there?
I have several. I have two that are I will give you highlights of, I guess.
Okay. All right.
The one is one story that has come to me in a very authoritative way involved a man who was involved in the Reagan administration at a very high level, who told a very good source that he had come to Washington and had been briefed at an underground base outside of D.C. for 8 weeks. And when asked what he was possibly being briefed about, he said, there is intelligent life in the universe, and I've seen it. And the person who told me this story said that they had asked him, this is back when Roswell was not on everybody's mind, so he might have ordinarily said, you mean Roswell, but instead he said, well, is it alive? I guess he meant did you see a dead body or did you see a live creature? And the person, instead of responding yes or no to that, said, well, that depends, which is kind of an odd statement. And the man also said that he cried himself to sleep every night. And the person who the story comes from asked him why. And he said, well, I have three girls, and this is the kind of world they'll grow up in. So I don't know what to make of that, but it's a pretty good story, and it comes from a good source. And I can tell you one other quick one. When Brent and I were doing Dark Skies, we had a launch party for the show at my house, and everyone who came was on a list. And if you came in on the list, this is kind of ironic, if you were on the list, we made you a little magic security badge. So you had 200 people wandering around with magic security badges on. It was kind of fun. It was a just kind of a cool thing for the night of the show breaking. And one guy was there, and the only guy who didn't have a magic badge on, because he wasn't on the list, came up to Brent and another one of my producers and said, you did a pretty good job with this show. We really like it. Now, it hadn't been seen yet, but he'd already seen it. He told us what he liked about it. He said, you got a few things wrong and all that. And he wrote on a napkin for both of these guys a bunch of weird symbols and handed it to them and said, you should keep this because in a few years it'll make sense. And both of these guys said, what is it? And he said, Secret of the Universe. And they said, well, I don't think I understand. And he said, sound, light, and frequency.
Wow.
And we saw that guy again later, and that's a longer story for another time. But
wow.
So those are the two, being briefed at an underground base and crying yourself to sleep, and the other saying sound, light, and frequency was the secret to the universe.
Oh, that's...
I'm not a scientist or a physicist, but I had not heard those kinds of stories from anybody else. I'm not making it up. Comes from good sources in both cases. I was privy to both of them, so I don't know. There
you
go.
Now, when you're a witness, or you know, to things like that, it changes everything in your perspective. I know. I've been there.
Well, when you hear somebody say some of those,
there's a lot of conversation on the internet and on different websites and throughout the entire metaphysical community about the others and what they want with our DNA.
Right.
What do you find in your research about that?
I wish I knew. I wish I knew facts. I'm confused because I lay awake and think about this sometimes and go, what really is it at work here? It would certainly seem that a scientific expedition that simply wanted to analyze the human genome, as we have done for ourselves, wouldn't need thousands of years to do it. They wouldn't need multiple samples taken from, you know, millions of people or certainly hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of people over multiple years. You wouldn't need that. So there's got to be something else going on. I know that from the reading, from Bud Hopkins to David Jacobs and so forth, there seem to be, you know, people, there's a strong sense of a hybrid program, which I know that we have talked about. So I presume that would involve the lengthy process that seems to be involved. But what I still would say the jury is out for me is, even if I was to agree to that, I've not seen direct evidence any more than anyone else, I guess. But I also would say, to what end? If it's a hybrid program, why? There's a lot of you can have a hybrid program for all kinds of reasons. Some of them are good, some of them are bad. So the good reasons, you know, you've talked about on your site and with yourself. But the bad reasons would be some kind of nefarious takeover kind of thing. The one thing that I will say, certainly was the theme in Dark Skies, just if I was an extraterrestrial or an other and I had designs on the Earth, I don't think the first thing I would do is come in and hover motherships over cities and blow everything up. That would seem to me kind of a counterproductive way to get your what you wanted. I think I'd rather use a little stealth and mystery and leave the building standing, kind of the neutron bomb approach to taking a planet. So I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew. I don't think anyone truly knows. There's experiencers that have their feelings, and there's the guys like David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins who have come to be more pessimistic, and for me the jury is out.
Yeah, okay. What do you personally believe about time travel? Do you have anything that you'd like to relate to us about your research on time travel? Have you run into it anywhere?
Well, I will say this. I believe I'm the first known writer to have a film produced where the Greys are time travelers, because that's what Official Denial, my sci-fi movie, is about, that at the end it's not where they're from, it's when they're from. So I certainly explored that thought, and I certainly thought about it for a long time. Do I have any inside knowledge about time travel? Not at all. Do I think it's possible? Absolutely. But I don't think it's as simple as most people make it. It certainly doesn't work the way it works in movies. I've certainly heard some of the rumors and some of the theories and so forth that have been advanced about it. But I think instinctively, and this is just a gut feeling, I think that some element of the others does involve some kind of manipulation of time. Time travel makes things sound a little easier, sort of a little more effortless, because time travel means, you know, like, hey, well, it's just like a nice sci-fi movie. I think it's time manipulation somehow, as opposed to time travel. And I can't be more specific than that. I just think that it's when the truth is known, we aren't going to, it's not going to be wrapped up in a neat, tidy bow, but it's going to be something a little more complex, and it may be so complex it's hard for us to even quite comprehend how it works.
What do you think about what's the tipping point that will be concerning our U.S. government admitting to what they've known all along? What do you think will be the 55.5 critical mass degree when it just...
Right. Well, I'll tell you one thing I don't think is happening. I don't think that there are secret keepers sitting someplace right now typing up a nice disclosure statement. I don't think that they are getting their plan dusted off and getting ready to do it. I think when it happens, it will happen and will surprise them as much as us, because it will simply be that events have overtaken their reality and they have to do something. One of the things that is clear these days is we've gotten a lot more sophisticated about public relations, etc. And even in the military, the military guys will tell you, when it comes to public relations, that the last thing you want to do is be behind the story. You want to be in front of a story. So
yeah.
let's just take – there's a number of triggers, and
yeah.
I'm not saying that any one is more likely than another, but let's just take an example. If we got good intelligence that China was about to disclose, that would cause kind of a panic, because whoever first discloses kind of owns it. They kind of – get the credit for it. And if we thought somebody else was going to go first, we might move up our timetable and beat them to it.
Yeah, I agree with everything you've said. Okay, Ariel, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, I think it's time for us to open up the phone lines and have people call in and talk to Bryce.
Well, I had a question. And it was almost answered. You almost went there, but the theory of the ancient aliens,
right.
Because we've been talking mostly about the last 60 years.
Sure.
And you said in passing, for thousands of years. So, I mean, you actually think that they've been here all along?
Well, there seems to be good, strong evidence. I'm not a believer that everything, if you watch the Ancient Aliens show, they literally have to keep a TV series going. I don't think every episode piece of evidence that they show is actually an ancient alien piece of evidence, but I think some of them are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the end of the day, it seems like the evidence for visitation is fairly strong. I don't try to explain everything in our ancient past by virtue of alien intervention. And it also may be that these ancient visitations, such as they were not as prevalent. They might have been more scouting, if you will, than current. I mean, it seems like since World War II and the use of nuclear weapons, there seems to be an increasing intensity to contact that didn't appear to belong in ancient times. But then again, I don't know. I mean, you could argue that there have been ancient civilizations that have come and gone. I mean, the Earth has been around a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's possible. But one of the frustrating things, I think, for everyone who dabbles in ufology is many things are possible. Evidence is hard to come by, and we are
right.
left with endless speculation. And one of the things that has always frustrated me is how if you try to make sense of everything that everybody's reporting about everything, your head will blow up. It's just too it's too much.
Yeah, we know that one.
And there are many of them are mutually contradictory, and the pieces I like to say it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle with pieces missing, and then realizing that not only you're trying to solve it and you're missing like 20% of the pieces, but some of the pieces you have look like they belong in a different puzzle.
Yeah.
And you just can't figure out what to do. You can't even make a move because it's so confusing. So one of the things I do hope that will come out from our future disclosure is a few more facts on some of those issues, which would be very nice. I don't think the esoteric ones are right. I don't think Jesus Christ was an alien kind of thing. I don't buy that. But I do think there's evidence for contact. And I also think when we talk about academia coming alive as never before post-disclosure, certainly they're going to have to rewrite all the history books to try to account for disclosure. And certainly ancient textbooks will have to be reinterpreted in light of disclosure. Same with archaeology and anthropology and psychology, you name it. Every ology out there is going to have to get back to work and find out how this disclosure impacts whatever they were thinking about.
Oh, I agree. Well, thank you for that. And I think we can now pick up some of our callers with questions. Is that okay with both of you?
Fantastic.
Yes.
Okay. First, we're going to hear from Jen. Hang on a sec. Hi, Jen. You're on the air.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
We're doing fine.
That's
great.
One of the best sound quality on a phone call I've ever heard.
Well, I credit my husband for a fantastic headset.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, he's pretty good about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I have several questions, but I know there are plenty of people waiting. The first question I have, and I have to honestly say that when you mentioned this, I almost welled up with tears. The person or the symbols that were received, the sound, light, and frequency.
Right.
Do you still have them?
Yes. I don't personally have them. Both my producers have. Here's one of the things that was interesting about that. The man that came and crashed this party, if you will, couldn't talk to me because I was hosting the party. And
sure.
So I was too busy to even give anybody 5 seconds of thought. And he cornered my two producers, and they each have them put away, but they both reported the same thing.
Now, and my guess would be that he didn't stick around for the entire party?
No, he did not. However,
yeah.
He continued to call us and arranged a meeting at the Dark Skies office where he brought in supposedly his boss. And Brent set this up. I was a little crazed because I was in the middle of producing a television series, and it's hard to be calm in the middle of that kind of hurricane. And so I really didn't want to take too much time with it because I figured, well, you know, look, this guy's probably crazy. Probably just gaslighting us, trying to have fun with the whole thing. But he seemed very credible, and he brought in an older guy that seemed credible, and they both said they were part of the Aquarium, Naval Intelligence, and that the older guy that came into office said to us, you got certain things right. You've got all the cover-up part right and all that. This ganglion stuff with your hive and all, and that's wrong. And he pulled out a vial, a kind of a glass vial with a screw top on it. Not like a pill vial, but something that looked more like a specimen vial or whatever. Put it on the table, and he said, that's why they're here. That's it. And he points to this thing. And it had what we both thought looked like gold or fool's gold or something in it. And he said that was the thing.
Hmm.
And so I don't know what to make of that either.
Well, I'm sure Lavendar and Ariel's minds are going a million miles a minute on that one. I know that mine is. So the second part of my question with regard to the symbols, would you be willing to share them?
Well, I think I might. I've got both my producers they've got them hidden, and I've asked them both to give me, I guess all I really want to say about that is I'm going to see them, and I'll make that decision later.
Okay.
But I'm not opposed to it, because I haven't seen them, I want to see them for my own eyes.
Sure. Absolutely. I would love to see them for my own eyes.
I've had people, I've told this story a little more often because of the Dark Skies DVD coming out and also because of the book tour and all that.
Right.
So I've heard more than a few people have sent me things when they've heard it saying, okay, well, here's what he's talking about with sound, light, and frequency.
Right, exactly.
So, but
exactly.
the fact that someone could say sound, light, and frequency in 1996 doesn't necessarily mean that it's an insight they couldn't have gotten from somewhere else. It doesn't mean they were who they say they were. It may mean that they are very good actors.
It could, which would make those symbols even that much more interesting to see.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is very interesting. And I have to say, at the time, I was intrigued enough until I expressed enough skepticism about it that the second gentleman said very reluctantly that he would set up a meeting for us in Long Beach in a cemetery at midnight with somebody else. And at that point, I said, I'm out of here. I got three kids. I'm not meeting anybody in a cemetery at midnight. And that was the last I saw of these guys.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, and this may date me a little bit, I had watched something from one of the TED conferences a couple of years ago, and there was a professor from Harvard, Lisa Randall, who specializes in quantum particle physics.
Right.
And she had some pretty interesting findings with regards specifically to time as it relates to multiple dimensions, multiple existence, et cetera, that for whatever reason I felt I wanted to share with you. And then finally, in Lavendar, this is kind of a combination for you and Bryce and Ariel. You know, a thought had come to mind for me, I want to say probably about a month or so ago, and I shared it with Sierra and felt compelled to share it this evening. But what are your thoughts, or what kind of discussion can we generate around, you know, for lack of a better word, a disclosure march? There's so much change taking place around the world right now where, you know, people are finally gaining the cojones, if you will, to stand up for some reasonable and needed change. If it were done correctly, meaning you had the right people there, the message is being carried in a way that it evolves throughout the process, but to actually have a march to encourage disclosure, what are your thoughts around that?
Oh, you mean like a some kind of public, sort of like the Million Man March kind of thing?
Right, on a very large scale.
Well, I'm in favor of it. I think we need to grow our ranks a little bit through the person-to-person contact, because I'll give you an example. I just spoke at MUFON Los Angeles and MUFON Orange County last week. And I really enjoyed it. I think the speech went fine. And there were a lot of wonderful people there. But there were only 75 at each group. And these are the MUFON people. So getting you know, and also I know that you, we think there's so many people out there, but it, they don't show up in big numbers at anything.
Right.
So
well,
I think we have to educate people about what the lessons of the civil rights movement were, the lessons of the Vietnam War protest. We may need, instead of mass, we may need to think about interesting things that we can do. I'll give you an example that doesn't require getting a million people in Washington, D.C. Let's say that they're putting a new iPhone out. Mm-hmm. What do we know about that? We know people will camp out the night before, and we know that the news media will all send their cameras to the iPhone lines and tell their reporters to file a story, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if we send we distribute 200 free black on white on black T-shirts that say "End UFO Secrecy Now," and give those away free to people in line if they'll wear them.
Right.
Now,
well,
when the media comes down there to cover that story about the new iPhone, suddenly there's a second part to the story of "End UFO Secrecy Now."
Well, then let me ask you this, and I promise I will leave it alone so we can open up for others. But
okay. Yeah.
I absolutely agree with you. I think there needs to be a phased approach. I think it needs to be very well thought out in order to get, you know, not only the pieces that you mentioned in terms of being able to learn from history, but also I think there is probably a larger community of people who either believe or have an inkling, but to your point that you bring up in the book, that are very fearful of having their face or their name associated
right.
with anything like this because of the ridicule piece
well,
of it.
Well, listen, disclosure would certainly help me. I've gone to family gatherings where I like to say they treat me like the drunk uncle because I'm the only one in the room that is up to speed on this, and the rest of them who haven't bothered to know anything I just kind of think it's, you know, well, that's Bryce. He's eccentric. So disclosure would certainly help me with those people. I think that that's a true thing. We have to figure out how to engage other people in an intelligent way
right.
and not just on misspelled, poorly punctuated internet
yep.
rantings.
Exactly.
We've got
because
to bring
they're
our
out
game
there.
Up.
How do we bring it together? So,
well, I'll tell you one of the things.
From where you stand right now, let's say,
yeah.
for example, I'm really interested in being able to put together a very comprehensive strategic plan for being able to facilitate something along these lines. Where would you recommend that I would get started?
Well, that's it. Well, I wish that you would become, I wish that first you would come and join us at the After Disclosure site as a reader and then as a writer. As an example, we're trying to create, as I said about the book, it's not the end of the process, it was the beginning of the discussion. So we've tried to create a vibrant place where people write
great,
well-thought-out essays, where they take these topics on in intelligent ways and add something to the discussion so that people from the outside, when they read it, don't dismiss us as all being a bunch of lunatics. And one of the things that I would encourage you to do is help us discuss these public issues about how we're going to motivate people and turn into what I believe we must do, which is turn into a social activism group. And at that point, then we need to figure out, again, as a group, you know, whether it's we can't just all be on Facebook pages, although
yep.
that's important right now. We have a website and we have a Facebook page. But we need to start taking things to the street
yes.
in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But first we have to meet each other and bond.
It's true networking.
And we need to identify those of us who are able to, I guess, cross over to the regular public discourse without alienating everybody and get people
right.
to be a part of it. I know that you sound very well spoken. So, for example, I would imagine that you're one of those people. I know that
I love public speaking, and I
well,
love the motivational pieces, and I love to write. So
it's important, and you might find your voice is a very strong voice in this area.
Okay.
So I'd encourage you to actually do join us at the Facebook page for After Disclosure, and do join us on the site so that I'll know who you are, and then maybe offline I'll throw some other ideas at you.
Perfect.
All right?
Great.
Thanks
Perfect.
For calling
Thank
in.
You.
Thank you so much, Jen. We are going to move on now. first I'm going to pick up the call. We have Paul Costanzo, who Bryce,
Paul,
if you wanted to meet, he's online.
Yes.
And then after that, I'm going to check in with Sierra at the chat room, and then we're going to be out of time.
Yes.
So here
wow.
we go. Mr. Paul.
Hello there.
You're on
hey,
the air.
Bryce. How are you?
Paul, I just want to say you knocked it out of the ballpark. Great work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for your kind words. What a terrific guest you are. I've just been really enjoying the interviews with Lavendar's questions and your explanations. Fantastic.
I have a question
really,
for
really.
You. When you
sure.
record, do you record full audiobooks?
Yes, I do.
Do they take days and days to do? I mean, that seems like such an arduous thing because it seems like everybody stumbles over a word now and then. You must have to do multiple takes, and it must take days.
Well, there's software that you use where you you edit yourself, but basically an unabridged book takes about 3 days, and that's about eight hours behind the mic, and then an abridged takes 1.5. So that's approximately how long it takes. But
let me ask you a second question. Would you then,
sure.
having looked at the AD book and participated in reading some of it, do you recommend to people the unabridged or the abridged?
Oh, always the unabridged.
Yeah,
absolutely. The hardcore readers or listeners of audiobooks always go for the unabridged.
That's what I would think, because I'd look at the book and I don't know what I could possibly cut to cut 8 hours to an hour and a half.
Well, I was just going to say the same thing. I mean, why would you want to cut anything out of this book?
Yeah. So it's an interesting problem. But I found myself compelled listening to you because I thought, I mean, I wrote these words, or at least co-wrote them with Rich, and I'm listening to you read them to me, and the way that words bang around in your head is different when someone says them to you than when you read them.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's what my job is, to bring words to life.
Yeah.
It would be an honor to bring this book to life, you know, with my voice. So,
well, I'll tell you something.
I'll talk to you about that.
Offline, you send me an email and we'll talk about it.
Okay, terrific. I'll get in touch with you through Lavendar.
Yeah, that'd be great. But again, I just want you did it was we have been so overwhelmed by all the things that go on in launching any big idea or any book or anything that the whole audio thing had sort of slipped through the cracks, and people had asked me about it, and I kept saying, well, we'll get to it, and maybe it is time to get to it.
Oh, this will be huge on audio, absolutely.
Well, thank you for that.
Okay.
Anything you want to talk about? I'm sorry, I've been monopolizing conversation here.
No, I just wanted to say hi.
Okay.
You know, I've listened to the story, particularly intrigued about the party story. That is very intriguing.
Oh, my. Well, I'll tell you something. Both of my friend producers literally have never forgotten that. I mean, they just keep, every time I see them and we're talking about this topic, they just cannot put that man out of their mind. He, and by the way, not a creepy guy, young guy, maybe 30, nice clean colored shirt, blue blazer, nice polished slip-ons, kind of looked like a Hollywood party guy, but talked like a Navy SEAL and looked like one.
Very interesting. Well, we've got a lot to share off the air, but
yes.
I know you're tight on time. So,
well, thank
nice
you. Thanks for
you
calling
and,
in.
Okay, take care.
Thanks, Paul. Great job. Bye-bye. Okay, I'm going to check in with Sierra here in just a second, but we have a caller with a question that I'm going to take for him. He says he's having trouble finding the book in major bookstores, and
yes.
And the computer says the book is somewhere online. It says it's sold out. Can you give
wow.
a location?
Okay,
can you give
first,
a location?
Here's the way that makes me sad and happy at the same time in its own odd way. The book is definitely available. If you go to a bookstore, you won't find it on their shelves. That's just not the delivery system we have, because we wanted to get the book out right away instead of waiting for a major publisher to get around to releasing it. The difference is about a year and a half in terms of turnaround. So you have to go. You can go to Barnes and Noble and say we'd like to buy a book, and they will order it for you, and it'll come right to you. I'm looking at Amazon.com right now, and there's no reason you can't get a book from them right now. And at Richard Dolan's publishing company, which is Keyhole Publishing, if you go to keyholepublishing.com, not only can you get the book, but it will be autographed.
Okay.
So I think you know, it's possible that certain places, like I can't speak for everybody. If you go to a Borders website, they're going bankrupt. Maybe they don't have books. I don't really know. But I know you can get it from Amazon. I know you can go to your local mom and pop bookstore. They can look it up and they will get it for you within 7 to 10 days at their store.
Okay. Well, I'd like to just say I got my copy from Keyhole Publishing and it came really quick. I mean, I had the expedited shipping and
they're the best.
Here.
I mean, they you know, and that's the other thing about it is it supports book publishing in this area, because Rich has other books that he's putting out in this area. So it's I think that's good. But listen, we like any way that we can get it in people's hands. Also, it's available on Kindle, and it's also available as an iBook.
Great. Okay, so the caller from 770, there's your answer. I'm going to check in now with Sierra from the chat room, and we're going to have to try to get through as much as we can. We only have about 9.5 minutes left. So, Sierra, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi,
hello.
Sierra.
Thank you so much, Bryce, for being with us tonight. It's just very, very exciting. So thank you for taking the time to be with us.
It's my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
So we do have a couple questions in the chat room. Have you yourself actually seen a UFO, or do you think that you may have been in contact with an extraterrestrial?
No. No, not really. My knowledge is gained the old-fashioned way by just reading about other people's experiences. But I'll tell you one other thing. Nothing as compelling as a personal experience, obviously, because you've seen something with your own eyes. You've had that experience. You know it to be true. However, another powerful way to sway someone's opinion, and certainly mine, is to read some of these documents that have been released from the Freedom of Information Act in the 70s and 80s, because these are documents that were not written at the time to ever be released, and they clearly show a government that is very, very interested in the UFO situation and some really excellent cases. So there's a lot of ways to come to this understanding, but mine is not through personal knowledge, no.
Got it. Okay. And it doesn't need to be. I'm just really happy that you've taken on this mission, because it really serves many. So thank you for doing that.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Do you know anything about, let me look here. You were talking earlier about time travel, and one of our listeners thought you mentioned something about white time travel. If you did, if we didn't misunderstand you, could you explain a little bit about that?
I wish I did. That would make me smarter than I am, but I don't know anything about it. I don't. What is white time travel?
Not sure. We thought we might have heard that.
No, I'm afraid not. I'm still stuck in, the time machine.
Yeah, I know. I think what he said was something like time travel.
Right. That's what I was talking. Yeah. I think what I was saying, just to recap that, was, and I believe this about UFOs in general, when the truth, such as it can be revealed, is ultimately revealed, the experience will be quite strange, and probably stranger than we see it. It's that old quote that the universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it is stranger than we can imagine. So I tend to think that applies also to time travel. I think what I was saying is we tend to think in time travel, even now, as it's a river flowing, and that somehow you're at one place on the river, and time travel would allow you to go upstream or downstream. But I believe what we're going to find out when we realize how time actually works on a practical basis, not just the theoretical one, is that it will be stranger than we imagine. It will be a little more complex, and it may be time shifting, time viewing. It may not be travel per se. I'm just not sure.
Okay, perfect. Well, I don't think that we have any other questions at this time. There were some other conversations, and and such, but we're just really enjoying your being on our show this evening.
Well,
please
thank all the people who have been logged on and listening and typing and writing, and I appreciate their support.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you, Sierra. I think we have time for just one more comment, and we've had a caller that's been waiting for quite some time. Let's see. Okay, we're going to talk to Gary. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi, everyone. I had no questions or anything. I really quickly just wanted to offer my love and support, and I love what you're doing, and keep doing it. It's this disclosure thing is very important. And if you need another VO guy, let me know.
Gary, when did you, for example, what informs your opinion that this is real? Do you have a story?
I do. I have several stories. I'm part Native American. I am also a Blog Talk Radio show host, I've been in radio for 30 years. And I have my own personal experiences regarding spirit and regarding extraterrestrial travel. And we haven't got the time for me to get into it now, but I shall at a future date, and I have before.
Well, listen, thank you for calling in, and I guess I'm thankful to all of you for keeping the level of discourse, you know, high and smart, because that's what we have got to do to make the case.
That's right. And that's how we influence all the rest of them. Keep planting the seeds.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks
thank
for
you,
your
Bryce.
Call. All right.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So just to recap here, we want to at least get everybody to the After Disclosure website and start reading. And that would be helpful to you, Bryce?
Yes, and I just want to let me throw those out. It's afterdisclosure.com. And mm-hmm. If you go there, you'll see that there are various places where you can read the introduction. So if you want to read the introduction before you even consider buying the book, by all means, please go do that. And also join the discussion and the debate. At the site, you can read articles that are created just for the site, not in the book. And that you can leave your comments. And also, if you're on Facebook, we are at we have a Facebook page for AD After Disclosure with like 2,800 people or something. And the dialogue is always best when new people are coming in and making these comments and elevating the dialogue. So I encourage all of you to join us. If you want to get the book, get it through keyholepublishing.com or amazon.com, either way. And love to all of you. I appreciate all the help.
Well, we have just been so honored by your taking the time to spend with us today, and our audience is so much behind you in supporting what you're doing and what you have done and things that you will do in the future. And I do encourage everyone to go to those websites that Bryce mentioned and help to keep the spiral going upward. Because, as we said, there is going to be some people having a fear reaction, and it's part of every Starseed's mission to stay steady and balanced and help keep it up spiral and positive. Because
I think that's true.
There may be some unpleasantness, but you know, think of it as growing pains. You know, it's all for the good, and I think that disclosure is going to shake out so many of the cracks in our foundation and replace it ultimately with understanding and further evolution in our consciousness. Lavendar, we have 1 minute left. Thank you so much. Those were great, great questions, and I appreciated the work.
Okay, I have just one comment for those of you listening that know about my discovery of star markings. The 25, 26, 27 degrees. And Bryce, you were born on May 17th.
Yes.
So that's right in the middle of the discovery of star markings that I've been talking to about our audience. So at another time, Bryce, I'd like to talk to you about those star markings in your chart.
I'd love you to do that. And I also want to say a very, very special thank you to you for not mentioning what year I was born in. Thank you very much. That's great.
It was just the date. I just mentioned the date.
Listen, it's fascinating. I have to say, when I was looking at your document and seeing those dates and realizing that's where my birthday falls, I got a little chill there.
Oh, well, I've done 30 years of tracking this, so, and we'll talk about it later, but thank you so much.
Well, watch
for
the skies,
the
everyone. You may see the future of it.
And know that we are supporting your After Disclosure book and all your work, and we hope that you'll come back and be a guest with us again.
Thank you. Good night, everybody.
You're welcome.
Okay,
and
bye-bye.
We will watch the skies. We will watch the skies and look for the future. Thank you so much, everybody in the chat room. Sierra, Purple Sage, thank you so much for all your help. We'll be back next. And once again, Mr. Bryce Zabel, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.